Hi, everyone. I'm Eve Harrow, Director of Tourism and Community Development for Win Israel Fund. Thank you so much for joining us in the newest of our series of webinars. Today is July 19th, 2021, and here in Israel, inching into the 11th day of Av, 5781. Win Israel Fund, as many of you know, is the premier organization for the last quarter century in helping fill in the gaps of the communities in Judea and Samaria, and also helping those who formerly used to live in Gush Katif and in the Gaza area. And I mention that specifically because we are in the week that also commemorates 16 years since the expulsion of the Jews of Gush Katif. And we are still involved with them, still helping them, as we do with the other communities, with security, with emergency equipment. I can tell you that the security equipment has just been upgraded in a lot of different communities, especially around the Gaza area, that has prevented just in the last few weeks some infiltrations. But we also have a happy side, and that's parks and playgrounds and sports fields and dance studios and synagogues. And so we thank you for those of you who are joining us, who have been involved with us for so long. We thank you. And for those of you who are new, check us out. In addition to our webinars, we also have virtual tours that we put out once a month. There's one that just came out yesterday on Kiryat Arba, on the B'nai Menashe community there, and on a lot of the chesed, on a lot of the loving kindness that the people in Kiryat Arba do. So it's a human look into the different communities that we so love and so support and want to have continue keeping them, keeping us, because I'm one of them, on the ground. I'm really honored this evening to have with us Dr. Jonathan Speier, who has a PhD from the London School of Economics, but has really spent his time and made his name as an author, as a journalist, and as a Middle East analyst. I've had the pleasure of interviewing him on my podcast over the years, and also spending some time with him at Limud UK, where his accent went off much better than mine. And he's really, I think, someone who can shed a lot of light on what is happening here in the Middle East. Very much, many of us tend to focus on Israel, and even within Israel, on what's going on in Yehuda Shomron and what's going on in the Temple Mount, especially in the last few days. And I think it's important sometimes to pull the lens out and see what's happening in our region, because that very, very much affects Israel's future, who our neighbors are. And so, Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us here this evening.
Thanks for inviting me.
So you had an article in the Jerusalem Post about Lebanon. So maybe you can, you know, begin and tell everybody like what your thinking is now on what's happening in our very feisty part of the world.
Yes, well, first of all, with regard to Lebanon, just briefly to say that Lebanon is an example today, I guess the first example of what happens when a country is subject to a kind of hostile takeover bid from the Islamic Republic of Iran over a period of three decades. That's to say, Lebanon was the first country in which the Iranians, through the agency of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, essentially inserted themselves and their interest and their power into another country. We're now three decades on from that, or in a way, even almost four decades from when they first came into Lebanon. The result we're seeing all around us, it is impoverishment and collapse and economic ruin to the point of real hunger among sections of the population and ruination among great, much larger sections. And that's the direct result, for reasons we can go into later on if people want to, in discussion of the Iranian project in Lebanon. Now, the thing is that that's of much greater relevance than purely, you know, to the tiny country to our north, because, of course, that Iranian project is underway also in Yemen, also in Iraq, and also in Syria. And also in a certain way, we could say even in Gaza. And it's of relevance also not only to those countries, but ultimately and primarily to Israel, because the reason why the Iranians are seeking power in Yemen and in Iraq and in Syria and in Lebanon and in Gaza ultimately is to utilize those territories as tools in their long war intended to result eventually in the wearing down and decline and eventual destruction of Jewish sovereignty in Israel. So for that reason, whilst Lebanon might seem, you know, a long way away, certainly to listeners in the United States, and in a way also to us in Israel, the interests of the Lebanese people, who are not necessarily friendly to us in any way, perhaps of minor concern, it shouldn't be of minor concern. It's of direct relevance to us. And as I said, you know, the project, the uranium project in Lebanon is only the same as the projects in those other larger countries, but it's further down the road. And we're seeing the results now of that decades-long effort in the ruination and collapse of Lebanon.
So you're holding Iran directly responsible for what's happening in Lebanon?
I'll tell you exactly, yeah, I'll tell you exactly why. Look, Lebanese Hezbollah is the instrument, was the creation of Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps in Lebanon in 1982. Now, in the subsequent decades to 1982, Lebanese Hezbollah has inserted itself into and disrupted and decayed and now destroyed every aspect of Lebanese public life. That's to say, it's inserted into the economy, with the result that investment has been driven away because Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and Kuwait, the Gulf countries, who used to use Lebanon as a kind of playground for tourism, and that accounted for 7.5% of Lebanese GDP up until just a decade ago, have now, you know, issued advisory travel bans to their citizens on traveling to Lebanon. Saudi Arabia has removed $4 billion of assistance to the Lebanese security forces. Saudi Arabia has also removed its financial commitment to the Lebanese Central Bank. The Americans also have sanctioned Hezbollah since 2015, Lebanon since 2015, because of the Hezbollah element. As a result of all those things, put together with 1.8 million Syrian refugees into Lebanon, also as a result of the Syrian civil war, for which Iran is in which Iran is a major player, put that all together, then you have the defaulting for the first time in Lebanon of the of its national debt in March of last year. And then, of course, the port explosion in August. Put all that together and you have a dreadful picture of collapse. And again, for the reasons I already said, trace it all back. The beginnings of the distortion come from the Iranian interest in Lebanon, which has driven away investment, which has distorted the economy, which has resulted in sanctions, and therefore which has resulted in default of debt, collapse of confidence, collapse of the currency, then the port explosion. And it means that you have now a situation in which governance is no longer feasible in that country, and in which effectively the country is turning to international bodies for help. Those international bodies are saying, we can only help you if you reform. And the Lebanese political system is held hostage by Hezbollah and therefore by Iran, and therefore cannot really reform itself. So yes, I would absolutely say so. It's a complex picture, but if you look hard enough at all the various strands, you sort of dial them back, you know, pull them back all the way, in the end, you will get to the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps and its influence via its franchise. And I'm always insistent to call Lebanese Hezbollah a franchise of the Revolutionary Guards Corps. It is not an independent organization. It is ultimately not a Lebanese organization. It's a franchise of IRGC. And ultimately, that's where the responsibility lies for the situation in Lebanon today, in my view.
So, I mean, you take it all the way back to 1982, which, of course, for Israelis is a big year because we get involved in Lebanon and there's a war, and then Israel is there for 18 years until the pullout under Prime Minister Barak in 2000. But many Israelis, myself included, were under the impression at the time that what we'd gotten involved with was a religious mess, in this case, between Christians and Muslims, the Lebanese having really a large population of Christians and as such being maybe the most modern Arab country, if you will, originally under France and later on its own. But you don't think that that's the case? Was it initially the case and then Iran took advantage of the rupture, or that really was something that we were told, but we were missing what you're just pointing out now, which is the evil of Iran, of the Shias, behind this whole thing?
Well, I think it's a complicated picture. Let's remember that Israel, of course, got involved in Lebanon in 78 and then in 82 because of the PLO takeover of a large swathe of the southern Lebanon, the same stretch that's controlled today by Hezbollah, of course. Now, Israel's military campaign against the PLO was very successful. Israel went to Beirut. And the result was that, of course, Arafat and the PLO organization was pushed out to Tunis. So in its immediate effect and with its immediate goal, I would say, and I think many others would agree, that you know, Operation Peace for Galilee was very successful. The problem was that Israel then, I think more from a strength of, an issue of inertia rather than any real strategic plan, just kind of stuck around in Lebanon, you know, stuck around in Beirut and then retreated a bit back to the Awali River in 85, but just kind of stuck around there. Now, the Iranians had come into to Lebanon already in 1982. In 1982, 1,500 operatives of the Revolutionary Guards Corps came to the Bekaa Valley in the east of Lebanon. What was their intention? Their intention was to do what Iran has done in so many other countries since then. Then it was new. Now we're familiar with it. Their intention was to create a political and military instrument, recruiting young people from the country in question, that that instrument might then serve the interests of Islamic Republic of Iran. And that instrument was first of all called Islamic Amal, and then later on changed its name to, of course, Hezbollah. Now, Hezbollah would have been created anyway, even if Israel had not gone into Lebanon, of course, but because it would have been created to recruit young Shia to fight the Christians and to fight the Sunnis if necessary. But nevertheless, it is true to say that the Israeli presence south of the Litani, and initially, of course, north of Litani as well, was a pretty good recruiting sergeant for the Iranians. They were able to exploit that presence in order to recruit young Shia, train them, say, look, the country's under occupation by the Jews and the infidels and so on, the Kufr and so on, and therefore it's your duty to join up and help fight them. And that is what they did. So Hezbollah would have been created in any case. It's not a product of Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon in the way which is sometimes claimed, but there's no doubt that the presence of Israel in southern Lebanon, in my view at least, after Arafat had gone to Tunisia without coherent strategic justification, it certainly helped along that process. And Lebanese Hezbollah, having then, in its own eyes at least, defeated, so to speak, Israel with Barak's unilateral withdrawal in May 2000, has then gone on to become, by far the most powerful political and military force in the country. It's militarily defeated and intimidated all possible opponents, including the pro-Western forces in Beirut in May and June of 2008. It's stronger than the Lebanese armed forces, the official army, which means at the end of the day, simply in pure muscle terms, nobody and nothing can stand against the will of Tehran inside the borders of Lebanon today.
So the Lebanese government and army is really just like a showpiece? There's really no strength there?
I would absolutely put it that way. I mean, I would put it in as blunt a term as that. I think this needs to be stated bluntly, precisely because the way in which precisely because of the attempts that are made to obfuscate that reality by trying to claim, no, the situation's far more complicated than that. Let us consider the various political forces in the Lebanese parliament. Let us consider the delicate sectarian balance contained in the Lebanese constitution and in consociationalism and half a dozen other things. It's all very nice. At the end of the day, it's not a source I would usually quote, but at the end of the day, Mao Tse-tung taught us that power grows out of the barrel of a gun. That's what Mao said, and he wasn't wrong on that particular occasion. And that was true in China, it's true elsewhere, and it's true in Lebanon also, which means at the end of the day, whatever notional, ostensible political system of representation is there on the ground, if one community and one political force has its own army, and that army demonstrably is stronger than any other armed force in the country, including the state armed forces, then that is, in my view at least, the true ruler of the country. That's the force that at the end of the day can declare an intention and make that intention stick by force of arms. And that is first and foremost what power is. Max Weber understood that a state had power insofar as it had the monopoly over the means of violence, right? That's how Weber accurately put it. In Lebanon, not only does the state not have that monopoly, but arguably, Lebanese Hezbollah effectively has that monopoly, in the sense there's other guys wandering around with guns in Lebanon. But at any given day, should it choose to do so, Lebanese Hezbollah, with the Iranians behind it, can neutralize any other force and insist on its will be carried through. So yes, absolutely, absolutely yes. The appearance of state armed forces, the appearance of state institutions, the appearance of representative institutions in Lebanon is, in my view today, nothing more than a carapace beneath which operates the real power. That's the power of Iran. And it is directed in strategic terms, not necessarily tomorrow morning, but in strategic terms, it is there and it is directed against Israel.
It makes it so much more difficult, of course, for other countries, Europeans, et cetera, in the West, who watch these starving people in Lebanon. I mean, we've seen the pictures. They're very difficult to see. Nobody wants to see children starving in the streets. Sure. But where are they supposed to funnel their aid? Because to some degree, the problem that Israel has with Gaza, if you want to in any way help the civilians, the money might end up in the hands of Hamas, and it's not going to the civilians. It's going to tunnels and other weaponry to attack Israel. So Is there anything that the Western world can do here or just watch Lebanon implode?
I mean, I think the Western world, is the responsibility of the Western world or of the international community, if we can use such a term, to to seek to aid Lebanon's plight. But I do believe that any such aid should be conditioned on two conditions. One would be the complete and thoroughgoing reform of the political system to remove the local levels of quite astonishing corruption that have led to and helped along the current situation. And secondly, and more importantly, frankly, any aid should be conditioned on the disarming of the Iran-led military entity in that country, because it just ain't going to help. There's no shortcuts. No. All of this is the result of the presence of that entity and its use of and its investment in the corrupt political system that I mentioned a moment ago. Those are the centers of failure and of state collapse inside Lebanon. So exactly in the same way that the Americans and the Europeans have impressively, over the last half decade now, stood firm against the demand of the Assad regime for assistance in rebuilding its country and feeding its people and reclothing them and rehousing them, on the grounds that no, until there is a political process underway which can lead to the ending of dictatorship in Syria, there isn't going to be reconstruction. In exactly the same way that that position has been impressively held to, I would say, until now, a similar set of stances should be in place for Lebanon. And it's not enough to take the position, as I think some Western commentators and political figures do, to say, yeah, but Bashar Assad is clearly an enemy of the West, whereas there are people in the Lebanese system who, at least in their own subjective perspective, are pro-Western. Yeah, it's not going to help. Those people are powerless to affect the situation. So their presence is neither here nor there and should not be the factor deciding policy, in my view. So there's no way around it. If you want to give aid, absolutely yes. But if you give aid to a system still dominated by Iran and by a corrupt political structure that works with it, then all you're going to be doing is giving money to Iran and to the people who accrue that corrupt structure.
Okay, so the only way to save Lebanon is to weaken Iran, in very simplistic terms.
Yeah, absolutely.
So absolutely, we've got it. Yeah. And so how do we do that?
Yeah, okay. And I would say not only with regard to Lebanon, but yeah, it's important to note, the only way to save Lebanon and the only way to save to bring a better situation in Syria and the only way to save such democracy as exists in Iraq and the only way to prevent the Houthis from reaching the Bab al-Mandeb and the Gulf of Aden, vital waterway for global oil supplies, is to defeat Iran. Yeah, because Iran, you know, is the fact behind military efforts of the enemy in all those contexts. And I would also argue, frankly, that the only way to properly defeat or deter Hamas in Gaza also goes via Iran, because the Hamas military capacity, as Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar himself said just a couple of days after the ceasefire in May, is because it derives from Iranian assistance and Iranian know-how. So yeah, it all, in this respect, you know, not, I don't want to be simplistic. It's not that every problem in the region goes back to Iran. It's not that the region would be democratic, happy and functional and would resemble Scandinavia, you know, if there was a revolution in Iran tomorrow. That's not true. The region has its own problems. Mm-hmm. But many of the armed threats, of the military and paramilitary and terrorist threats that face Western allied countries and that face Israel today do directly trace back to the Iranian effort at regional domination, which is what we're talking about here.
So having said that, we have a question here from Steve Gilbert. To address potential consequences of the removal of the U.S. sanctions, et cetera, what's going to do to the Iranian proxies? How do you see what the new administration in the United States, the direction that they're going in? Is it going to help the situation or make it worse?
First of all, it's worth noting that for all the efforts made in Vienna so far, the administration has not yet managed to get back to get the Iranians back to compliance with the JCPOA of 2015. And this, I think, is something which we ought to note, because it's not obvious why that is the case. I think the administration thought that it would get to Vienna and very rapidly, you know, re-sign a new deal or re-sign the JCPOA and then start negotiating this new deal that the administration talks about. And that would be that, and it would be a quick success, a quick study, and then they could get back to the foreign policy issues that concern them more, you know, in the Indo-Pacific and facing China and so on and so forth. It hasn't happened. And it's interesting to note why it hasn't happened. My view, at least, I think what we're getting a clear sense now is that the Iranians, having from 2019 onwards, gone into their own very clear non-compliance with the agreement aren't necessarily easily going to be pulled back into it, because they've started enriching now to 60%, because they've started using a larger number of advanced centrifuges than the agreement permitted them, and they now have a stockpile of enriched uranium. All of that is outside of the parameters of the agreement. So if they want to come back into the JCPOA, they have to give up a whole bunch of stuff that they've created over the last 2 years. That's proving very, very difficult. And I think that the latest noises I'm hearing coming out of the administration are also sounding quite doubtful. They were pretty bullish at the beginning. Now they're like, well, you know, this window's not going to be open forever. We're not going to keep these negotiations going forever. The negotiations, the last round ended on June 20th. The next one will begin when the new hardline Iranian president, Ibrahim Raisi, takes office. So there's no, first of all, there's no certainty at all that this administration is actually going to get to the point where it's got Iran is back to JCPOA, and then Iran gets all those notional rewards. We might not even get there, and we're not there yet. Now, if we do get there, let's assume that we do, and Iran goes back into compliance, and the sanctions are then, the various sanctions are then lifted. I'm afraid that the benefit to Iran in that case would be immediate and would be extreme. Let us remember that, you know, whatever one may say about the Trump administration's strategy of maximum pressure and the way in which maybe it enabled Iran, once it stopped being in any level of compliance, to actually rush closer towards a nuclear capacity, it is without doubt that the sanctions did have the effect of slowing down the Iranian regional advance. On the eve of the coronavirus in early 2020, early spring 2020, and me and my friends were watching this from very close up, there were anti-Iranian riots and demonstrations underway, and on a large level in Iran itself, in Iraq, and in Lebanon, right? As I say, in three out of the four or five countries you can count as the kind of Iranian empire in the region, so to speak, there was essentially popular revolts underway. And these were all could all derive back to the fact that the Iranians didn't have money to buy people off, to buy off the populations that effectively live under their rule. Now, those riots and demonstrations were great, not only because in themselves it's good to see the Iranians challenged, but also because we were always, those of us who watch this stuff closely, were always saying, we need to find ways to keep the Iranians busy in their own backyard. You know, they're trying to bring the fire into our backyard. That's exactly what their intention is. And we should try to find mechanisms that get to repay the compliment, so to speak. And the fact is that the policy of you know, harsh sanctions implemented within in the last half decade by the then Trump administration did have that notable and noticeable effect on the Iranians, which means very clearly, if you, you know, very obviously, if you reverse that, if you reverse engineer that, you know, if you start putting, you know, tens of billions of dollars back online for the Iranians, without any doubt whatsoever, tens of billions of dollars will start flowing back into the coffers of the various Iranian proxies in Lebanon, in Iraq, obviously in Iran itself, in Yemen. And yeah, it's no, you know, it's not rocket science, so to speak. Of course, if there's vastly more amounts of money and resources available, that will enable those organizations to begin to organize and to move forward. And that's not what we want. So that would be very, very bad. But yeah, if they get back to the agreement, and then if they get rid of the sanctions, then that will without doubt happen.
Do you trust the Europeans especially to make sure that even if the sanctions are removed, you know, they're not, the money isn't flowing to where it shouldn't, or there's no way to ensure that? There's just too much money there, too much profit to be made.
I think there's, and,
you know, and maybe not even an understand, or, I mean, I hate to be cynical, but maybe they don't care. You know, as long as different people in Europe are making a lot of money and different companies are making a lot of money. So what's going on in the Middle East? So the people are living under totalitarian regimes and suffering terribly. Okay.
I do think there is, European countries do differ on the level with that. I mean, the French have been a little bit better than others and so on. It does vary. But yeah, by and large, I mean, over the years, when I've spoken to European diplomats from various countries here and across the region, in Iraq as well, you know, about this issue, you know, once you get beyond the kind of niceties, yeah, I do think what you hear from them, and the more smart or honest ones among them will tell you straight, you know, look, we get why Israel thinks that Iran is an existential problem. I mean, you know, if you were Israeli, you probably would, if I was Israeli, so to speak, they say, you know, if one was Israeli, you might think that too. But, you know, from their point of view, Shia political Islam, Hezbollahs and so on, not really a primary concern as far as they can see it. A few years ago, maybe still today, Sunni political Islam, Sunni jihadism, was having a very real impact on the European consciousness. You know, in Germany, in France, in the UK, in Belgium, in Spain, they were realizing, hey, this just isn't something we can afford to ignore. These guys are letting off bombs in our streets. And Sunni political Islam has, in many ways, I would say, transformed the public space in Europe. When you go to Paris, when you go to Brussels, and you see, you know, armed infantry soldiers walking around in the streets of the capital in a way that, you know, we don't see here in Israel, for example, that comes down to Sunni political Islam, and the Europeans are aware of that. But, you know, when it comes to Shia political Islam, the Revolutionary Guards Corps and the others, there's a sense of complacency. Now, I think to some degree that may be changing a bit now, because now there's a long list of Revolutionary Guards associated acts of terror that have taken place in Europe over the last 3 or 4 years. The Iranians seeking to hunt down dissidents in Denmark and in Holland, an attempted terror attack thwarted, it's said, by Israeli information in Paris just last year, a discovery of very large consignments of ammonium nitrate in London, in a house in London, again, from what we hear, as a result of Israeli information given to British colleagues there. So there is maybe a seeping in a little bit that it's their problem too. But by and large, I think for the most part, not. The Europeans don't feel particularly that this is an urgent matter for them. Yeah.
And the Americans are completely oblivious to what's happening here, A, because they're really not being threatened, at least currently, by jihadists and by terror attacks the way the Europeans are, or why? Any idea as to why this administration is trying to do what it's trying to do?
Well, it's important to remember that some of the people, you know, while the style and language of President Joe Biden may be notably different to that of President Barack Obama, you know, a lot of the people who are in the administration and also working on Middle East are actually the same folks.
Right.
You know, the person who's running the negotiations in Vienna, for example, is Robert Malley. You know, and Bob Malley is known as somebody who, you know, very much was on line with the Middle East outlook of the Obama administration. Now second term Obama, at the time when the JCPOA was signed in 2015, many smart analysts were of the opinion that Obama, and I think Obama even himself more or less said it openly, I'd like to find the quote, but you know, the notion that they had was that America needed to pull back from the Middle East. America was finished with, you know, stupid wars or whatever in the Middle East. And what America needed to leave in the Middle East was a kind of strategic balance. And that given that on the one hand in the region, you had Israel and Saudi Arabia and other US allies in conflict with Iran, what was needed was kind of to bring Iran back into the fold of normal countries. Now, according to this notion, much of the Iranian misbehavior, so to speak, or dysfunctional, strange, unacceptable behavior in Iraq and in Yemen and in Syria and in Lebanon derived from the fact that the Iranians were not being permitted to take their place in a sort of concert of nations, so to speak, in the Middle East. And therefore, they needed to be given incentives and brought back into the fold. That, I think, I mean, it may be a crude rending of it, but that, in essence, was the Obama administration's outlook regarding Iran and indeed regarding the Middle East. Now, Biden talks a bit differently. There are people like Blinken and Sullivan who, some people here in Israel who I know who know them say have a different, maybe more hawkish outlook. But I wouldn't be that surprised, you know, if the deep thinking, so to speak, within the administration was not, in fact, all that different to the outlook I just described. So if you have that outlook, if you say, you know, maybe in a slightly more hawkish sense with Biden, it might be, well, look, we've got a real enemy in China coming along. We really don't have time or bandwidth anymore for forever wars, as they call them, you know, in the Middle East. So we need to sort this out and get to you know, confronting the real potential threat of a Chinese Navy that's going to be ready to fight the U.S. Navy by 2040, according to Xi Jinping's supposed ambition, or probably is his ambition. So that outlook can maybe still bring you to an outlook that says, okay, therefore, we need to sort this out one way or another. We need to bang heads together. And one way to do that is to kind of bring, incentivize the Iranians back into normal behavior. You know, something like that, I suppose. It's all good. It's all okay. The problem is it just doesn't grapple with or engage with the real nature of the Iranian regime. If the Iranian regime was different, then by all means, you know, if it was run by someone like Hosni Mubarak or General Sisi, okay, by all means, incentivize them and bring them in as best you can. You know, they don't have to be perfect liberal Democrats. It's prepared to, you know, to behave in an acceptable way. It's not that. It's not that. It's a revolutionary regime powered by revolutionary ideology and no less by, you know, radically revanchist ambitions with regard to territory and control and power in the region. Iranians, this regime cannot coexist with anything resembling the current balance of power in the region because its vision requires or imagines a role for Iran so far in advance of where Iran is currently at that it can only be achieved by the confrontation with and defeat of the main countries constituting the main power structure in the region today, specifically Saudi Arabia and, of course, Israel also.
Israel
centrally. And with regard to Israel, of course, that one should not forget, and I think we would be naive to forget and derelict in our duties to forget, here there is the religious and ideological element, and I don't believe in casting that aside or ignoring it. No. In other words, you know, it's in the mix. The desire to end Jewish control and sovereignty over Jerusalem and the way in which that is seen to fit into a kind of eschatological religious outlook held at least by some of the senior people in Iran, I think is something which we have to also take into account.
Well, and a side benefit of messing up Lebanon, of course, was hurting the Christians. I mean, that didn't bother them either in their quest for Shia power over the Middle East. So
just to the Christians there. I mean, yeah, that's true, of course. But I think that there is it's important for us to remember with regard to Lebanon. The Lebanese Christians are a broken reed. The Lebanese Christians, in my view, are finished as a political force, like so many other Christian communities in the region. Now, the Lebanese Christians are vastly stronger than the Iraqi Christians or others. But, you know, the direction they are on in the Middle East is out of the Middle East. And that's true for Lebanese Christians, too, I think, tragically.
Well, there used to be a large Christian community in Egypt as well. And you mentioned Hosni Mubarak. So, you know, Egypt is almost astonishing in how it's not in the news right now. And for so many years, Egypt was really like one of the main powers here in the Middle East, certainly one of Israel's major enemies. And now, except for an occasional something having to do with Gaza and some diplomats or some helping with negotiations or opening a corridor, Egypt is almost glaringly quiet. How do you figure that in terms of, I'm glad, but is there... Is this kind of, as they say in Hebrew, sheket medumeh, like a false quiet, or they're so involved with internal problems that they don't have the strength to deal with anything regional?
I think that they are basically engaged in very, very urgent internal economic problems. I think also it's worth remembering that Egypt, between 2011 and I guess 2013, 2014, had 3 years of very, very grave and deep instability, of a kind to which Egypt is not particularly accustomed. You know, unlike the Levant, so to speak, unlike Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Yemen, also if you go further out, where, you know, political unrest, Libya, for example, you know, where political unrest is pretty much a constant, Egypt, for the most part, has been used to very repressive but relatively stable governance, accompanied by periods of great instability. So, for example, when the Free Officers came to power in 1952, that was preceded by several years of after the 48 War, of very, very great instability, the deposing of the monarchy of King Farouk and so on and so forth. But after that, after 1952, 53, 54, there was, you know, pretty much a half century of, and a little bit more even than a half century, of relative political stability, stagnation, certainly, corruption, certainly, governance in dysfunctionality, certainly, but not unrest. And then in 2011, unrest hit, you know, in a very, very real way. Right. There was revolution, there was chaos, there was a year of truly chaotic governance in the form of Muslim Brotherhood government. And I can tell you from my own work, I mean, I had the chance to speak to some members of that Muslim Brotherhood government early 2012 in Europe, in a European city, with other Israeli interlocutors. And, you know, we were really shocked, frankly, by, and this is a group of people not necessarily that easily shocked, especially by Middle Eastern dysfunctionality, you know, we were really shocked by the low caliber, the astonishingly low, you know, narrow horizons and ignorance and conspiratorial thinking of the people close to the Muslim Brotherhood government of President Mohamed Morsi at that time. And the notion for us that those people were in charge of, you know, the largest Arab country with the largest Arab population, a strategically vital hub for regional peace was truly, truly, you can even say terrifying, especially when from an Israeli point of view, they were not only the custodians of the largest Arab country, they were custodians of the peace deal that formed the anchor, so to speak, of Israeli normality and of Israeli economic advancement and everything else over the last previous quarter century. So the thing is, I think many in Egypt felt the same way. And of course, most importantly, the people in the army felt the same way. And effectively, in July 2013, what took place was that they just restored the old regime. They essentially brought back, you know, Hosni Mubarak's uniform, but just with another guy wearing it. That really is what it's come down to. And what has happened is that Egypt has now returned to the fairly familiar previous situation of a deeply repressive, airless, you know, there's very little political air to breathe there, so to speak, but nevertheless, relatively stable regime. The Muslim Brothers are crushed. They have not ceased to exist, but they're not coming back as a political and certainly not as a military or paramilitary force for any time to come. The ISIS insurgency in northern Sinai is not completely destroyed, but it is contained, by the way, with very great levels of cooperation.
Yeah, from Israel.
Between the Egyptian and Israeli world, but it's been managed at least to a degree with help from Gulf countries, specifically United Arab Emirates, in terms of financial contributions. And there we are. And Egypt has even begun to show in the last year or so tentative signs of beginning to engage in regional diplomacy again. Of course, it's an important member of the East Mediterranean Gas Forum, of which Israel is also an important member. Sisi was also involved in a state visit to Baghdad recently. That's to say that, you know, they're trying fitfully to create a kind of Arab diplomacy again, about which we can discuss, by the way, because it's not sufficiently acknowledged yet in Western media, this new tentative Arab diplomacy that's emerging, not all of it, of the implications of which is good, by the way, but it's showing the extent to which at least the Egyptians feel confident enough to not only now be solely concerned with internal issues. So that's effectively where it's at. The reason why Egypt's, we're not hearing about Egyptian internal unrest is because there isn't that much right now. There is a very repressive, heavy hand of government. There's a lot of civil society activists and Islamist activists in jail. And that's going to be the situation for some time to come.
So they're in kind of their chronic phase of dysfunction and not in an acute one at the moment, if you want to put it in medical terms. So how about to our east? What about Jordan? Because Jordan has been in the news, where for some Israelis, it kind of came as news that we weren't getting along so well with Jordan when the new prime minister made a secret visit. And obviously, why was it secret? And why didn't Jordan want anyone to know? And then there's been somewhat of a kerfluffle about Israel selling water to Jordan. And should we do that? Where do you see Jordan fitting into this? Because, of course, Jordan is really kind of our vest, if you will, to some of the really nasty neighbors further on to its east. So how do you see what's going on with Jordan now?
Yeah, it's important. First of all, I think we'd add to the picture this interesting story in recent months of a supposed coup, a supposed planned palace coup in Jordan, supposedly involving Prince Hamza, another of the younger son of the late King Hussein and the half-brother of the current king, Abdullah, and according to the Jordanian claim, at least, involving some remote control from Saudi Arabia and from Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in Riyadh. Now, we don't quite know how much of that's true and how much of that's fiction, you know, sort of 1001 Nights style fiction. They've just jailed a guy called, I think his name is Rami Awad Allah, who is supposedly was one of the ringleaders of the supposed coup. He got 15 years in jail. It was just this week that the verdict came in. So that's another, you know, curious little story to put in with regard to Jordan. Look, Jordan has been in difficulties, not so much of its own making, but not really connected to Israel, over the last decade. First of all, the country has taken in, you know, a very large number, between 1 million and 2 million Syrian refugees which, you know, mm-hmm. for a relatively small country, and not poor. Particularly economically successful, poor, yeah, this has been very, very difficult, and it has led to some unrest, because, of course, those people have not all stayed in refugee camps in the north, like Za'atari, where they're supposed to be. Many of them have come down to the capital or to other cities, where they then compete with Jordanian workers for jobs, and they're prepared to work for almost nothing. So that's a thing we're familiar with. That produces then unrest and anger among the local population. So they do have that element of issues, I would say. There is, of course, still, you know, there is also, from what we hear at least, an issue of discontent among some of the tribes who have been traditionally loyal to the royal house, to the Hashemites. Yeah, who are not pleased with the king's behavior and very, very critical, from what we hear at least, of the queen, of Queen Rania's behavior. And Queen Rania is regarded as someone who's, let's say, doesn't quite have the common touch and is seen as somebody a little bit living a very lavish and mm-hmm. gilded and splendid lifestyle at a time when Jordanians are not doing well economically. So there's a great deal of anger about that and so on as well. My own view, at least, is I'm relatively optimistic, I'd put it, about the chances for the Jordanian monarchy to survive. Just I think it has all kinds of hidden safety mechanisms, safety valves, so to speak, for letting pressure off that other regional regimes did not have. It has the regime, or the monarchy, whatever we call it, you know, has a great deal of Islamic legitimacy, which I think we shouldn't underestimate the importance of that. Obviously, the Hashemites themselves regarded as descendants of the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, firstly. I think, secondly, Jordan is a very homogenous country in ethno-sectarian terms. We always heard about the thing of Palestinians on the one hand, mm-hmm. East Bank Bedouin on the other. Yeah, that's true. That is a real division that you feel when you go to Jordan. But let's never forget the crucially important fact, in my view, that both these Palestinians and these East Bank Bedouin are Sunni Muslim Arabs, right. Which means that when it comes to the really important sectarian stuff, actually mm-hmm. they are kind of on the same ballpark. Which means that the kind of factors that led to revolution and civil war in Syria, or led to revolution in Egypt or in Yemen or in Libya or elsewhere, are not really present in Jordan, in spite of the problems that certainly do exist there. So I tend to be fairly optimistic about the chances of the monarchy's survival. I certainly do hope that Israel, you know, for whoever may have been at fault, it may well be that King Abdullah himself was engaging in deliberate provocations with regard to the Harabait and so on to right. gain himself legitimacy among his exactly. people. We should never forget that. And people who speak closely to the monarchy in the past from Israel, who I've known, who've worked in government on that level, will always say, yeah, the way he sounds in private, it's always very different to the way that he speaks in public and so on. So I certainly hope that is the case. Whoever was at fault, I do think that that level of cooperation between Israel and Jordan is important. I do think it's a national security interest for Israel, as well as obviously for Jordan. And so I do mm-hmm. hope very much that we'll get back onto an even keel, so to speak, in the period ahead.
Well, it's still our longest border. And I mean, the last thing Israelis want is, I mean, it's almost impossible to defend from Eilat all the way up to the Golan Heights.
Well, you're right. It's our longest border. And also, as you said in your question, behind that border, you know, after Jordan, are some of the most powerful and hostile forces mm-hmm. imaginable, whether that is, of course, Syria, whether it is Iraq, or indeed whether it is Lebanese Hezbollah, you know, coming round and engaging. We've had instances in the past of acts of terror, by the way, against the Israeli diplomatic targets by Lebanese Hezbollah, and therefore by Iran, on Jordanian mm-hmm. soil. You know, right mm-hmm. down there in the Dead Sea Valley and so on. So, so we have to be very much aware of that. Yeah, it's deeply important.
Now, of course, the other major player that we haven't mentioned yet is Turkey. Mm-hmm. How do you see them fitting into this fun amusement park of the Middle East? Because Erdogan, you know, needs to stay relevant, shall we say.
Yeah, Erdogan has elections coming up in 2023. But my own view, at least, is that Erdogan has, to such a great extent, emptied Turkish civil society or political life of content, such that though that date may actually be less important than we're thinking it is. You know, in a similar way to what Vladimir Putin achieved over a period of years in Russia. Mm-hmm. You know, if you empty the courts of any content, if you put your political opposition in jail, you know, if you empty the army of any potential independent opposition to your activities, and if you nullify the free media, and if you largely even neutralize your own form of political allies, the Gulen movement in Erdogan's case, and you then hold an election, you know, the likelihood of that election actually meaning anything, you know, becomes, let's say, much reduced. And that pretty much is the situation in which Turkey is in today. And by the way, with Turkey, we should remember, you know, if you create a new constitution in which you create a new position for president, and that president then has, you know, supreme executive authority, which is what Erdogan's done, then, you know, the chance of you being voted out of power become very considerably reduced. The Turkish economy is in trouble, and as a result of which there have been, famously, there have been local setbacks for Erdogan in the last couple of years, specifically in the mayoral elections in Istanbul last year, or was it in late 2019, when AKP, his party, were soundly defeated. But having said that, I don't think we need to worry too much, if worry it would be, about Erdogan's internal position. And what about his external stance, which of course is what interests us? Well, he had a 40-minute phone conversation with our new president, Yitzhak Buji Herzog, just a couple of weeks ago, shortly after Herzog's inauguration, in which he pledged himself, and the two men pledged themselves to the joint goal of improving Israeli-Turkish relations. I don't tend to put a great deal of store in any of this. We've kind of been in this movie before several times, you know, in power now for nearly two decades. And Israeli-Turkish relations have tended to go up and down. They tended to go up usually when Erdogan wanted to curry favor with the United States, which is, by the way, exactly what he wants to do now, because the Joe Biden administration is much, much more hostile to Erdogan than was the outgoing Trump administration. Trump, for all his more hawkish and welcome positions on many Middle East files, was for many of us almost inexplicably soft on and tolerant of Erdogan's positions and of Erdogan's expansionism and support for Sunni political Islam in the neighborhood and all the rest of it. Biden, by contrast, has been much, much more consistently critical of Erdogan. So I think one of the reasons why we now have this situation of Erdogan trying to draw closer to Israel again is because he probably thinks, as do many anti-Semites like himself, think that, you know, Israel controls America, or if you want to get on with America, it's good to be good in with the Jews at the same time. So we shouldn't be surprised about that, or shouldn't ignore that element as well. But what we also know from Erdogan's situation is that, you know, the fact that you're his friend so-called today doesn't mean that you're going to be his friend tomorrow, because the next time when he needs, for this or that populist reason, to, you know, insult the president the way that he insulted Peres on the stage at Davos back almost in 2015 or so, you know, calling Israelis Nazis and killers and the rest of it, you know, he won't hesitate to do so. The fact that he's had a nice phone call with the same president a week earlier won't stop him from doing so. It'll be meaningless. He's an opportunist, and he's a demagogue and a populist. And for all those reasons, Israel and Jews are always useful targets. And I would want to add as well, as we said with regard to the Iranians, don't forget, it's not only opportunism all the time. It can also sometimes be genuine ideological conviction. There is such a thing as that in the world as well. And I think that Erdogan, his career suggests it, is a very, very committed Sunni political Islamist who wants at a strategic level to change the republic created by Kemal Atatürk 80 years ago into another republic, into an Islamic Republic of Turkey, which will have the leadership of Sunni Islamic elements across the region. And I think that his hostility to Israel, and in his case, I think we can say it also, his hostility to Jews, frankly, is, you know, central to the man's worldview. And it would be very, very unlikely if that then were to be able to be surpassed, you know, by a kind of effort to rebuild normal relations with Israel. The other thing to note about Turkish-Israeli relations is that Erdogan is an opportunist, and he can be pragmatic when he wants to be. And the fact is that the trade volume between Israel and Turkey, all the way through the years of bad-mouthing Israel, has gone up because Haifa Port was of strategic importance for the Turks, because they export stuff down to the Gulf. And during the Syrian war, they weren't able to take the stuff across land between Syria and Iraq for obvious reasons. And the alternative route they found was sail it down to Haifa Port, take it across Israel to Jordan and then to Saudi Arabia. So you know, so the, for all his ideological stance against Israel, that stuff kept on flourishing at the same time. And Israel apparently was okay with that too. So that just carried on going.
We collected our taxes and moved it along. Oh, it's kind of been an open secret for a long time that the Israeli ports and the access to the Mediterranean have been, and then going into Jordan, have been kind of an open door to the Arab world and to some of the things that they're importing that they can't, either because of the mess in Lebanon or because the Suez Canal isn't always what they'd like it to be. Do we mention Russia here? I mean, we focused really on the Arab slash Muslim countries. You mentioned China as... We're not going to talk about China vis-a-vis Israel. Do you see Russia getting involved here in some of the mayhem?
Russia's involved. I mean, you know, the Russians are back in the Eastern Mediterranean. They're back now, of course, since their successful intervention in and Syria and preservation of their strategic ally in newly re-elected President Bashar Assad. You know, so they're back. They are developing the Tartus and Latakia naval bases. We are told that, I think it's Tartus, they hope within the next half decade we'll be able to receive submarines. This is of strategic importance to the Russians. It's the only naval base that they hold outside of the borders.
With
of
a warm water port. And people don't realize that Russia can't use their ports a good part of the year because of the weather.
This can bring the Black Sea Fleet into the Mediterranean. So it's and they can dock, you know, in Tartus and Latakia is very important. The Khmeimim air base, also the S-400 air defense system is there. That was the base from which the planes that effectively won the civil war in Syria for Assad took off from. So yeah, the Russians are here. From Israel's point of view, or from, I say, from everyone's point of view, that's a mixed bag in the sense that Russia is not really committed to anything or anybody except for Russia itself. You know, anybody who had the notion, and some of our enemies did have this notion back in 2015 when the big Russian intervention into Syria began. Many of our enemies did have the notion that, great, well, Russia has now come effectively to take leadership of the existing bloc of Iran, Assad, Lebanese Hezbollah, and the Shia militias. Well, you know, it rapidly became apparent to them and to everyone else that nothing of the kind was true. The Russians did come in to preserve the Assad regime, but they are in no way committed to or interested in Iran's goal of, you know, hollowing out Arab countries, filling them up with Shia militias, and then directing that militia force against Israel. That's simply of no interest to the Russians at all. So they are there, and they are an uncomfortable presence sometimes. But I think what certainly has been apparent for Israel over the last half decade is that many of Israel's central interests do not necessarily collide with the interests, the self-perceived interests of Russia, and that if you keep diplomatic channels open, as indeed former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu worked very, very hard to do, if you keep diplomatic channels open to the Russian leadership, you may well find that you can make your case and continue, for example, conducting a campaign of strategic bombing against Iranian infrastructure in Syria, even when the Russians have the state-of-the-art S-400 air defense system operative in Khmeimim. And even when they've given the S-300 system, supposedly, to the Assad regime, you can still carry on doing what you think you need to do, as long as you don't tread on the feet of the Russians themselves. That may require some fancy footwork, so to speak, diplomatic or otherwise. It may require a great deal of deconfliction between the Kiryat in Tel Aviv and the Khmeimim air base.
Defense ministry.
Syria. Absolutely. The defense ministry is located in Tel Aviv, of course. But you can do it. And Israel's been doing it. So it means that we don't like the fact that Russia's here in the way that it is. But frankly, everything we've been talking about, you know, for the last hour, in my mind at least, is underlined or is underlain by, as we're looking at it, the apparent desire of the United States to quite significantly reduce its footprint, not to leave, but to quite significantly reduce its footprint in the Middle East. Nature and the Middle East, you know, abhor a vacuum, which means that if the Americans are going to lighten their footprint, other powers are going to come in. There ain't nothing really much we can do about that, except try our best to, you know, coexist with their interests as best we can. And in that regard, I would say that our experience with the Russians over the last half decade has actually been, you know, not bad at all.
Could have been worse in the relative scale that we have here in the Middle East. So absolutely, there's a country that we haven't mentioned that used to be a major enemy of Israel. Does it exist anymore? Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Iraq is, I think, you know, since we're speaking mainly to American friends in this session, in this audience, Iraq is something which I think should be interesting them and us very much, because the fact is that since effectively, we can judge it, I guess, pretty much from mid-February of this year, there is a growing Shia militia insurgency directed against United States forces in Iraq. There have been 26 attacks using rockets or drones, right, against U.S. forces since the Biden administration took office. I say the last half year now. And mm-hmm. just in July, there have been a whole series of attacks, including on Ain al-Assad base using rockets where U.S. forces are stationed. And the clear desire is to force the withdrawal of those 2,500 United States military personnel that are currently present on Iraqi soil, because the Iranians surmise that as long as those forces are on Iraqi soil, they will not be able to intimidate the elected government according to their will, to the extent that they would like to and intend to. Now, I think mm-hmm. my sense from looking at the US press as I do every day, I mean, my sense is that the urgency of this matter has not sufficiently been internalized by Americans right now. There is a perception, and I'm in no way saying that the withdrawal from Afghanistan is wrong. I understand exactly why Americans are tired of being stuck in Afghanistan. But there is a sense that the headlong withdrawal from Afghanistan will have an impact on the credibility of U.S. force presence in other parts of the world. And I have no doubt, there's no doubt in my mind that the Iranians are watching that too. And they're saying, hey, if we could repeat that performance in Iraq, if we can induce an American withdrawal under fire from Iraq and therefore from Syria too, that'll be a damn fine day's work from our point of view, from the Iranian point of view, because it'll leave us, one, with a perception of victory against the US, and secondly, just with a much, much greater freedom of maneuver in Iraq mm-hmm. and Syria, and thenceforth towards Israel, because the Americans just won't be there as a barrier. And right now, those American forces, 2,500 in Iraq, I said, and also a related 1,000 in eastern Syria, controlling, let us not forget, 30% of Syria, including its oil and gas resources, in cooperation with Kurdish allies on the ground there. Now, that's a major presence still, small numbers, but a strategically mm-hmm. significant presence. The Iranians are currently looking to destroy that, and they're looking to destroy it by gradually upping the ante, so to speak, of attacks on US forces to a point where they believe that the questions about their continued presence. And I think they are informed also by the fact that, you know, that in Congress, there are significant voices in Congress, especially from the Democratic Party side, which are very much questioning the reason why U.S. forces are still indeed in Iraq at all. They're saying, well, they were supposed to be there to defeat ISIS. Didn't we defeat ISIS already 3 years ago? Why are we still there? And if you want to say they're there to challenge Iran, let's have a conversation about that. You know, those voices are rising in intensity too, I think. So the Iranians are looking to induce the United States withdrawal under fire in Iraq. That's a real insurgency. It is underway. And it's something which I think deserves a much greater volume of attention than it has currently received.
So in the last few minutes that we have remaining, more on a personal note, you and I know from conversations that we've had over the years have sometimes gone into countries without your passport necessarily in your pocket in order to really, should we put it that way, in order to really get information, I mean, real information from people on the ground. What can you tell us, what can you tell us about that? I know that I don't know if anyone sells you life insurance, let's put it that way, because you really have endangered yourself in many ways. What drives you to do that? To get the truth out as much as you possibly can to the world?
Yeah. First of all, I should say that, you know, that we're talking now about 2019, early 2020. I'm afraid that those activities, at least were temporarily curtailed by the coronavirus.
Right.
And I think now that that's maybe hopefully retreating a little bit, we're starting to think about some ways of doing that again. But yeah, for the best part, I guess, of a decade, a little bit more than a decade, about 13, 14 years prior to that, I was very, very busy with that stuff in Lebanon, first of all, then in Iraq, in Syria, in Turkey, also, and elsewhere. The reason is, Eve, because what I realized was that there is actually, if you want to do this stuff seriously, there really is no substitute for getting in on the ground, not just arriving in a place. I mean, that's pointless. Anybody can buy a ticket and just say, hey, I was in Baghdad or whatever. Not that. But, you know, building up a deep and existing network of smart people and friends, you know, and eyes and ears on the ground in those countries, and then going in and with their help, you know, getting in to see what's really happening, speaking to the right people, getting the right pictures, seeing the right, you know, in the right places at the right time, gives you a level of empirical information and knowledge, which I think is absolutely vital, not only for us as, you know, us as producers of it, but I think is vital for, no less vital for the consumers of that information, namely publics and policymakers in Western countries, in the United States, in Europe, and in Israel too. People need that information. And that information was not readily apparent, especially in those years of, you know, really very great historical instability and change in our region. I can say without going into to huge detail on this, but just I happen to know that even for Israeli policymakers, you know, who have, let's say, probably the best eyes and ears and the best intelligence network in the business across the Middle East, even there, in some moments during the Syrian war and the events in Iraq over the last decade, you know, they were suddenly also faced with new players who all of a sudden had power on the ground, and they had no contact with them. They thought, well, who are these guys? We don't even know who they were yesterday. And suddenly they're controlling great swathes of territory, and we need to think about them. And, you know, in those situations, I and my colleagues were very glad to sometimes be able to say, well, hey, you know, we were actually in there last week, because right. We kind of thought these guys were have been important for a while, just in their own little, you know, civilian researcher, journalist way. So we can certainly give you some information. We can certainly, you know, tell you a bit what's going on in these parts of the country or parts of the region where systems have been flying blind. You know, that's less the case now because it's a little bit more stable now than it was 5-6 years ago. But I still absolutely stand behind the importance of work on the ground. Also, for very, very, for very concrete stories, I can tell you that myself and my colleagues, for example, were the people who broke to the world back in 2014 the use by Islamic State of chemical weapons in northern Syria and in Iraq. And we were able to get to that because we were in touch on the ground with the people fighting ISIS and with the people who'd been impacted by the use of chemical weapons. So it's also, you know, sometimes just straightforward, concrete information the world needs to know. And it's also sometimes that by being there on the ground, sometimes you can get impressions of trends and of events and of directions of events that you just can't get from sitting, you know, looking at the internet, no matter how much information, of course, is available online. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's no substitute for being there on the ground. So it's been very important for me, and vitally important for me in my work over the last decade or decade and a half to carry on with that element of it.
Mm-hmm. What they call human intelligence, the body language, the language. Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah. And you've been right there, even though I remember years ago, you were the only person who even came close to helping me understand what was going on in Syria, all the different groups that were sometimes fighting each other, sometimes all fighting Israel, sometimes Israel helping one of them just because it was less of a threat at the very minute than another group was. And and that whole mess. And I know that you spent some time there and were also able to get some information. And I imagine that as an Israeli, others in different people in other countries were also, you might be the infidel and they might be people who on the face of it would never have anything to do with you because they're a Shia or a Sunni and you know, you're a Jew from Israel, but understood also that what you were getting at is the truth and that you were, you know, you could also maybe help them in some way figure out how to get past some of the things that were going on. I mean, it works in two ways. You know, not just gathering information, but in some ways calming that down. So you're looking forward to getting back and getting your adrenaline surge.
Yeah, well, we have plans. Look, it's nice to get out and about in the neighborhood now and then. And that's starting to look like hopefully a possibility again. And also, of course, to get out into the Western world again, because another large part of our work, apart from being in the region and gathering information, was also kind of disseminating that information, so to speak, in Washington, in London, in Canberra, in Ottawa, you know, in important Western capitals, as a no less important element of the work we were trying to do. So yeah, absolutely.
To the policymakers.
To policymakers, absolutely. Yeah.
So how can people be, first of all, the little bit about the books that you've written, and how can people be in touch with you if they're planning a conference, hopefully again, pandemics, you know, post-pandemic, and want to bring you in, how would they go about doing that?
Sure. So with regard to the books, I have two books that I've written. One is Transforming Fire, The Rise of the Israel-Islamist Conflict, which focuses on Israel-Hezbollah and the background of the 2006 war and so on. The other is a thing called Days of the Fall, A Reporter's Journey in the Syrian-Iraq Wars, which is self-explanatory. It's about my work reporting on the ground in Syria and Iraq. Both of them are available on Amazon.com. And with regards to getting in contact with me, I'm easily reachable at jonathan.spire@gmail.com. Easy to remember, and people can write to me there or at Facebook or on my website, jonathanspire.com. Very easy to be reached, and certainly very happy to advise, give information, and yeah, to available for speaking at conferences and so on, for sure, as well.
Right. And I think provide some very much needed analysis, because most of us really don't have a clue as to what's going on here. And unfortunately, some of the people who don't have a clue are in positions of power. And that is that is already quite frightening. So so what you're doing, I think, is really a benefit to all of us in the Western world who would like to see fewer people die and conflicts be at least managed, if not solved. And hopefully, not exactly unicorns, but come to some place where the world is a little less violent and nasty than it is today.
Sure, okay. Absolutely.
All right. Yeah. So Dr. Jonathan Spire, thank you so much. I learned a lot, and I know that my viewers and listeners did as well. And of course, if you know of somebody who would have enjoyed this conversation, this has been recorded. It will be going up on the Win Israel Fund site. If you're on our email list, it will also be sent out within the next day or so. And feel free to pass it along. And the more people hear this and try and get some understanding of what's happening, which affects all of us. Jonathan and I are both here in Israel, but these issues and the countries that are around us are not just focused on Israel, even though that's the main goal, but definitely focused on the West and on creating havoc wherever they can do so. So this applies to you as well. All right. Thank you so much again, Eve Harrow for One Israel Fund. Keep in touch with us and the projects that we have. Next webinar will be in about a month, as will the virtual tours. We're always busy, as we said, doing whatever we can to keep Israel out of the news as much as possible by keeping people here safe and happy. So take care, everybody. Thanks again so much. Thanks to Shana and Cyril for monitoring things behind the scenes, and to One Israel Fund for sponsoring this webinar as well. Take care, everybody. Goodbye for now.
The Land of Israel Fellowship is going strong. Learn about the secrets of the Day of Atonement. To join the Land of Israel Fellowship, our special premium learning experience with Jeremy Gimpel and Aria Bromwitz, go to thelandofisrael.com/fellowship.